Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The subject of today's interview on August 16, 2005 is Professor Harold Shoaib of African Languages and Literature. And we're going to begin today, Harold, if you would start talking about your childhood and early years, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. I was born in Gary, Indiana, August 26, 1931. And as I think back on my childhood, I had a typical kind of a childhood. I was brought up in a very strict upbringing. I remember my parents, very devout Lutherans, church every Sunday, a very, very rigorous kind of an upbringing. But when I think back on my childhood, I think of three themes that sort of run through my early life. And they weren't major at the time, but I think that they sort of rumbled in me and percolated, so that over time they became more and more important. And I think that I can understand where and how they were rooted. One of them was Gary, Indiana itself, and being brought up in Gary in the 1930s and 40s, one was very much aware of racial stratification. Gary had a large African-American population, but they were totally segregated from the rest of the community. They were on one side of town and the whites were on the other side of town. And I remember the Gary Post Tribune, which was the only newspaper in town, a black person in Gary could be born, grow up, marry, and die, and it would never be recorded in the newspapers. There was no news about blacks in the newspapers unless it was sensational. And I became aware of this at an early age, and it was a matter of enormous, I think, for a kid, it was a matter of interest to me. I wasn't brought up, race was simply not a major topic of discussion in my family, although certainly it was. I wasn't brought up in an anti-black environment. It simply was the African Americans did not exist, and that was it. And so here were all these people on this other side of town, and it was a matter of enormous fascination to me that there was no connection between them. So this sort of rumbled. I went to a high school, Tolleson High School in Gary, a purely white high school. I do remember that late in my high school career, when a student became actively engaged in attempting to integrate the schools, and he was taken one night by other students, and his head was shaved. And I remember that, but it simply was never a major concern in the classroom. The teachers didn't touch the subject. Mm-hmm. So that was one. And then another, when I was in high school, we used to go out. I had three brothers, and my parents used to take us out for walks in the evenings in the summer. And during the Second World War, I remember that we would be walking down the streets. A couple of times this happened, and some people would shout "Hitler and his children" because my name. My parents were both of German descent, and I remember my father would go over and talk to them, and apparently try to reason with them. But that got me to thinking too. I very early I made the connection with the way we in the white people in Gary were dealing with the blacks, and then suddenly I got just a small taste of it. With this anti-German kind of a thing, it was very, very. The Lutheran church that we went to, it was a German Lutheran church. They had services were in German, but during the war, my father never spoke German. we didn't have, I never learned German at all. My grandfather, on my father's side, was born in Germany, but they simply, it was as if Germany didn't exist. I never had an understanding of where I came from in Germany, or anything like this. My parents didn't touch this. It was a matter of enormous concern. They were obviously trying to protect us, but they were obviously being overly protective. So that's the second theme that sort of ran through my early life. And the third one, as I think back, for 3 years before I went to high school, fifth grade to eighth grade, my parents sent me to a parochial school.
Lutheran
school. And it was okay. Three teachers in the school. It wasn't a very big school. But I became enormously concerned, and I think that I really think back as I look back. I think that I pretty much lost my religion when I was in the eighth grade, because I couldn't understand the teachings in the classroom by these teachers, who taught that the only people who would end up in heaven were going to be Missouri Synod Lutheran people, and all everybody else was chancy, and that Mary Baker Eddy was a disciple of the devil, and that the Pope, that they would never see heaven, the Catholics. And that troubled me too, because what the heck? I mean, are we narrowing our world, you know, to this extent that only Lutherans are going to end up in heaven? And this was the sense I got. And I couldn't buy that. And so that really made me, I can still remember it, in eighth grade, really made me start to question that. And I never openly questioned it. My parents would never have allowed this. They were so strict. And from then on, all through my high school years, I played the game. I learned how to dance the dance. And I did what I had to do, and it was almost instinctive, I think, by that time, because my parents were so strict. But it was another element, I think, in my early life that really made me, you know, want to escape Gary, Indiana, and everything that Gary, Indiana represented to me. My father was a postman. It was during the Depression. There was no money. We had a tiny house, four kids, four boys, all in one bedroom. It was a rough time. When I got into high school during the summers, I would work. I worked in the EJ&E Railroad, Elgin, Joliet, and Eastern Railroad, I think it was, as what they called a Gandhi dancer, you know, where I worked with these guys. They were hobos, you know, they were fly-by-night people. Uh-huh. And they would come to Gary and work for a little while and go on their way. And my job with them was to keep the railway tracks clean. I'm just a kid. But wow, the schooling that I got from these guys went much deeper than anything I was getting in the schools. I mean, we would sit around and talk, and they, you know, they were very open, very in a very gruff, forthright kind of a way, talking about what life was like. And so I picked up this innocent kid. I picked up this stuff from them. So they were really important to me. When I got
your parents probably did not care that you were working.
No, they encouraged me to, because this gave me some spending money.
Uh-huh.
They figured it was a. I never told them about these guys. I remember once going to work. There was the Calumet River, I think it was, running by the steel mills in Gary. The EJ&E was out by the steel mills. And the bus stopped. I was on a bus. And the bus stopped, and there was a lot of a traffic jam because one of these guys had tried to commit suicide. And he jumped into the Calumet River. This is really so pathetic. The Calumet River was so dense and, with gunk from the steel mills, that the guy, you know, went up to his waist, and so he wasn't drowning. And I remember we got off the bus, and there he was sticking his head under the water, this pathetic person trying to kill himself. That sort of thing. When I got out of high school, I really knew I wanted to get out of Gary. I didn't know how. I had no money. I had I got a scholarship to Indiana State Teachers College in Terre Haute. when I got out of high school, but it was just for tuition, and there's no way I could have afforded going there. And so I was looking around, how can I, you know, for my ticket out of Gary. And for a year after I got out of high school, I worked in the steel mills and the sheet and tin mill, Gary Sheet and Tin Mill. And again, I remember a man whose name was Story, a very religious black man. And I remember his name very well because every time we would see him, we would sing. He was very religious. This is my story. This is my song. You know, and he was a lovely man. And he, very gentle, and then a very in-your-face African-American, younger guy. I got to know them, the two, very well. And I really learned about what life was like in the ghetto in Gary from these two guys. I mean, they really, in one in a gentle way and one in this rough way, told me what life was like.
Was this your first contact with Afro-Americans?
From time to time in my childhood, I would meet African-Americans, but never to this extent, never to this intense, everyday kind of an extent. They were wonderful. They just sort of, you know, in their own way, they took me under their wing, and they were educating me about what life is like. So that was very important to me as well.
Harold, let me ask you, you strike me as intellectually curious and aware from a very early age.
I think I was. I when I think back, I think I was just like any other kid, you know, a street kid. I enjoyed the things that everybody enjoyed. But there were some things that were going on with me, and I never spoke to people about. I had a very close friend, and we never talked about these kinds of things. You know, we talked about whatever kids talk about in grade school, high school. But yeah, when these two men, it was just for that one year. I'll never forget them. It was just an amazing experience for me. First of all, it was, I really learned from them what life is like in the ghetto, you know, where one of them was brought up in Gary, Indiana with a mud floor in his house. I couldn't conceive of this. And then, you know, not being able to have any kind of meaningful connection with white people. It was, you know, the 1930s and 1940s, this country was still pretty much locked into this racist environment, even in the North. So, anyway, I was really, that year in the steel mills, you know, they used to joke about kids growing up in Gary that instead of going to the University of whatever, you would end up in Caltech, they called it, which was these steel mills were run by Calumet something or other, and they called Caltech in a cynical, ironic kind of a way. This is where kids ended up forever. I mean, you were locked into this kind of environment, and I really wanted to break out of that.
Would you say that the majority of the boys that you went to high school with did end up in the mills?
An awful lot of them did. This was, we lived, the Tolleson area, West Gary, was a working class kind of a neighborhood. Some, not many, some went to university, but not many. Mm-hmm. As I think back on this, they had good lives and so forth, but no. Mm-hmm. I think that not many went to university. Mm-hmm. Then the Korean War comes along. And during the Korean War, they still had the draft, and I was, you know, I was still not ready. I was still not of an age to go in to the army, but I my whole future, I was trying to put it together, and I didn't want to wait around. A year was long enough working at the steel mills, so with my friend, I decided to join the Air Force. Foremost, because it was my ticket, because they still had the GI Bill in those days, and 4 years in the Air Force, I would have 4 years at university, tuition and beyond tuition paid for. So, and I was sort of adventurous at this time, and I really did want to get out of Gary, and so here was a chance. And for, you know, for a kid who had limited resources, it, you know, probably was about my only chance to get out of there. I have nothing but good to say about what the Air Force did for me, but on a very personal level. You know, I was like in W.H. Auden's poem, The Unknown Citizen. I was a guy, you know, when there was peace, he was for peace, and when there was war, he went. You know, I had no real strong feelings. I did develop strong feelings about our presence in Korea during the time that I was in. I still remember that taking the train, it was from Gary, from actually Chicago, I had to go to Chicago to San Antonio, where I had my boot training. And we stopped in St. Louis, and I remember getting out of the train, and in the train station, you know, here all the signs were, where the Johns, you know, the Johns were coloreds only, whites only, coloreds only. So what I had experienced in Gary, here it was painted, you know, very clearly for me. I might just add, I'll get into this later, but years later, when I went to apartheid South Africa, then I saw it. I saw the terrible result of this kind of treatment of human beings, where it resulted in this absolutely deadly human experiment that went on for 350 years in South Africa. Here in America, we were getting out of it. We were really coming to the end of it. 1954, when the Supreme Court made the decision, I went in the Air Force in the early 50s, so it would happen while I was in the Air Force that this gigantic thing would happen, and you know, the floodgates would finally open. But going to Texas, and when I got into Texas, also, very strong separation of human beings. In San Antonio, where Lackland Air Force Base was, where I did my boot training, it was with blacks, but mainly with Latinos, with people from Mexico.
Harold, before you go on to the military, in an earlier meeting that you and I had, you talked about Eleanor Roosevelt as an influence in the 30s and 40s.
You know, and she was also very important to me. I think that, you know, first of all, I was drawn to, I remember I was a paper boy when I was a kid, and I remember when Roosevelt died, I knocked on a number of doors as I was delivering the paper, you know, to tell them what had happened. I was feeling so bad about what had happened. I didn't know that much about Roosevelt, but I did know that Roosevelt was responsible for a lot of really splendid things, and also the country was very much behind him because of the war. Mm-hmm. Eleanor Roosevelt, it was well known that her relationship with FDR was not all that great. She had her own life. But I can still remember in the pictures in newspapers of Eleanor Roosevelt going down into the coal mines with coal miners. But perhaps even more important, because this happened during my experience in Gary, was her efforts to work towards equality for blacks. She was very open about this. Roosevelt, her husband, was not that open. In fact, it was during this period, I still remember too, that because of Roosevelt and the U.S. Congress, when a boatload of Jewish people who had escaped from Hitler were coming to this country, many of them kids, we turned the boat around, wouldn't let them in. And they went back and probably went into Auschwitz and places like this. We don't know, but the fact is that we closed our doors to them, and that was FDR, but mainly the Congress, but also FDR. Anyway, the thing that attracted me about Eleanor Roosevelt was, again, from a kid's perspective, but by now I'm growing up, and I'm thinking about her ideas about what they called one world, and wow, was she castigated for this. You know, this whole idea that that there is no separation between human beings, that we're all the same. And, you know, this country, we go through pulses of this. From time to time, it's all one world, and then we go, as we have in the last 30 years, we get into this thing of separation and diversity and all of this, mm-hmm. you know, which are, for me, become code words for continued separation. So I was really, she really appealed to me. Again, it's not that I studied that much about her, but I knew enough about her and what she stood for. And also, what attracted me to her was that she stood in the face of enormous criticism. First of all, a woman involved in this sort of thing, you know, at that time, this was not a woman's place. Mm-hmm. Second, her fractured relationship with FDR. But most important, this woman who, you know, herself experienced, a kind of an angst kind of a life, mm-hmm. That here she was, devoting her life, you know, to people who had nothing and to people of color and so forth. So, yeah. She was very much woven into. I worked more. I as time went on. I studied more about her, but she's there as I think back in my life at a very early period in my life, no question about it. And became, you know, as I went into the Air Force, this became more and more of the case. You know, when I went in the Air Force, this country was going through a rough time. First of all, the good news was we were moving up to 1954 and the Supreme Court decision about segregation in this country. But it was also the time of what's his name from Wisconsin, McCarthy.
Joe McCarthy.
And this was a very difficult thing for those of us in the service because, you know, we didn't dare express opinions about this because, you know, we were meant simply, taught simply to support the country. That's it. And a lot of my fellow people in the Air Force, they supported Joe McCarthy even to the point where he was making people, you know, give names and all that sort of thing.
So you and your fellow soldiers talked about McCarthy?
We did talk about it, but it was dangerous to go too far into this. But you know, it's what McCarthy was doing was, you know, what we've done to Judith Miller, you know, today. Uh-huh. It's that sort of thing. If you don't cooperate, in jail you go. And that's what McCarthy was. He really scared me. So, you know, and this gets you to thinking about, okay, what am I in the Air Force for? I'm meant to help protect what this country stands for. And here is this guy, you know, who is flying in the face of everything. And here are these Johns in St. Louis that are, you know, are against everything. So there were, you know, more and more, I think, aware of the fact that we weren't living in a perfect, you know, kind of a democracy, that there were real problems here. Then, you know, during the Second World War, I was very much aware, the country was, of what we were doing to Japanese, of putting them into concentration camps, with no reference whatsoever, you know, to the courts or anything. This was really removing Japanese people, Japanese Americans, from any kind of protection in this country.
And you were aware of that as a teenager?
We were all. This was going on, and it was a debate in this country. Most people seemed to me to be supporting it, because after all, you can't tell about, you know, Japanese were called Japs. The cartoons and newspapers were absolutely dreadful in their depiction of Japanese people. And then suddenly here, the Japanese were, you know, without any rights whatsoever, and thrown into these concentration camps in the desert, in semi-desert areas. So there's a lot of that sort of thing going on. So this is percolating, but it's coming more and more to the surface, you know, as I'm moving through the Air Force. You know, I was a jet mechanic. I never dreamed of being a jet mechanic. This was what they called the needs of the Air Force, you know, and so I learned to be a jet mechanic. You know, jets were new. It was exciting to be doing that. I went up a couple of times with pilots, you know.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I never flew, but I went up in those things. It was wonderful. And and we were going to Korea. That was the idea. They were preparing us to go to Korea. So after I did my boot training in San Antonio. I love San Antonio. I got around a lot in San Antonio, you know. Just a lovely city. I liked the possibilities of a city where, more than in Gary, but dangerously so also, where, you know, Hispanics and whites moved, you know, fairly fluidly together, although not as fluidly as one would like, but better than in Gary. I just like international kinds of places, and here, this is my first real experience of that. Before I get into that, I should mention another thing that was happening to me back in Gary was when I was out of high school, I working in the steel mills, I finally had enough money, I could go into Chicago from time to time. I love Chicago. I fell in love with architecture at that time. In another life, I would be an architect. That's a passion with me. Chicago was wonderful for architecture. I would walk the streets by myself, and I found the Blue Note in Chicago. It's gone now, a jazz place. I mean, all the jazz names were there. And I fell in love with jazz. So jazz, that became a very important part of my life.
So you discovered that on your own?
On my own. I would go into Chicago sometimes with some friends of mine. We would date, go into Chicago. And at that time, I thought the thing about big cities is restaurants, good food, and all that sort of thing. And so we went to, fine restaurants, save up money, go to fine restaurants, and get, steak that is bleeding because that's the way people eat it. And, I refuse to admit to myself that this was ridiculous. It was not the food, thing. And in the end, when I went in by myself, I would just walk the streets, loved it, and then found the Blue Note, would go there, and other jazz places too, but the Blue Note was wonderful. And fell in love with jazz. And I had already, my parents used to listen to classical music on Sunday mornings, I remember, before we went to church. And so I liked classical music. And so a kind of another stream of music, it's classical jazz that I love, and classical music. So that became, that's another part, another thread of my Anyway, San Antonio. And by the way, while I was speaking of music, while I was in Texas, I spent a lot of time in Texas. I found this other category of music, and that's Western music, and I like that too in a way. I used to go to the bars with guys from the Air Force, and there would be these live music, and it was Western music, and I kind of liked that. Certainly nothing like jazz and classical music to me, but it was kind of an interesting part of the life. When I became, when I was told I was going to Jet Mechanic School in Wichita Falls, I wasn't too keen on this, but, when there was war, you went.
And they just assigned you?
That's what they did. They called it the needs of the Air Force. I didn't have any choice. I don't even remember if I ever expressed a choice. I was there. I was going to be there for 4 years. So I went to Wichita Falls. My God, what a place. It was so depressing. They hated airmen. In fact, at times, we couldn't even go downtown to Wichita Falls because people in the Air Force were being attacked. People just didn't like them. It was not a fun time. But that's where I learned, about how to take jet engines apart and put them back together and that sort of thing. Then they shipped us out to California to go to Korea. And so we landed there, right outside San Francisco. I forgot the name of the airbase. And then the Panmunjom hearings started. And everything was put on hold. And we didn't know we were supposed to board a ship. We didn't know whether we were going to go or not. Mm-hmm. And the Air Force didn't know, because the war was on hold. Mm-hmm. And so for 6 weeks, six really quite splendid weeks, because they didn't know what the heck to do with us. And so every day we would have to check in, and then the day we were free to do what we wanted.
Oh.
And I explored Northern California and Oregon. I fell in love with Oregon, one of my favorite states, because it was so wild, and the coast and the mountains and all that sort of thing. I can't remember the name of the city. It was where Clark Gable was born. I remember it was the big thing for them.
In Oregon?
Yeah, some in Southern Oregon. Or if he wasn't born there, it was a big city. Maybe he had a house there or something. And it was, I can't remember if Clark Gable was still alive at that time. Anyway, so I explored that. We went all over San Francisco and to a lesser extent, Sacramento. And then the whole thing was canceled. And then they really had a problem, because I had another year and a half, 2 years to go in the Air Force, and they didn't know what the heck to do with us. So I became a jet mechanic instructor. They sent me back to Texas, to Amarillo, Texas, where I stayed for, pretty close to 2 years. By this time, something else is happening to me. I'm starting to read Plato and Aristotle. I don't know how in the heck I did, but I got into these. And I really started finding these very interesting. I still remember during an inspection at Amarillo Air Force Base, the captain came in and he looked at my desk and he said, "What's this, Plato?" He said, "Where is the Airman's Handbook? I should be reading the Airman's Handbook." I remember that very well. I went to Amarillo Junior, I think it was called Amarillo Junior College. And I took a psychology course, and there was a teacher whose name was Gail Crownover. I've kept in touch with her. She just died recently. And she was quite wonderful. You know, I think I was the only airman in the class, and she sort of took me under her wing and also sort of helped me to blossom, not only into psychology, but into other. She encouraged my reading and so forth. She was a pretty good influence on me, I thought. At the same time, I had a lot of people. You know, you're living cheek by jowl with people, so I got to know a lot of people from all kinds of walks of life, including a lot of African Americans.
So the quarters were integrated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very definitely. By this time, you remember Truman integrated things,
yes.
And so by this time, it's pretty much the way it was. But of course, it wasn't integrated. But
of tape one of the August 16th, 2005 interview with Professor Harold Schoeb.
So the there was still, you know, for all intents and purposes, segregation, but living when I was in Amarillo, we weren't in dormitories anymore. We had rooms with three people in a room.
Oh.
But I really, again, meeting African Americans from the South, and you really got an earful of what was happening, you know, in their homes and how bitter many of the black airmen were. So I listened. It was mainly for me part of my education. I listened to the stories, and I heard many stories from them. I heard stories from whites of a variety of different social economic classes. So I became much more aware. It was very important to me because, you know, being brought up in a tight home in Gary, here the world was opening to me, and I was more and more aware of the way other people lived and so forth. So all of this, it was very good. I never regretted the Air Force. Sometimes it got boring. I wasn't too crazy about, you know, falling out in the morning and that sort of thing. But, you know, it was a very disciplined kind of a thing. And I think that I was of an age when I could use the discipline. So I don't regret any of that. And I really did. Now I was really under the influence of all kinds of people, including Gail Crownover, but others as well, and my readings, I was reading much more broadly. I can still remember when I was in high school, I went to my friend's house and I had bought a copy of the Atlantic Monthly. I still remember it. It's had a picture on the cover of a union leader, AFL-CIO or something like that, and she made fun of me, you know, and said, "Oh, you'll never read that." You know, she thought I was just being presumptuous, you know, and arrogant and so forth. So, you know, there wasn't an encouragement, you know, to do this, to blossom, to get involved in things when I was a kid. But so I was on my own. I started reading. I read just everything imaginable. And by the way, just in case I forget, the two books that have had the greatest influence on my life were Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov and Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. Incredible books. I didn't get to them until later, but I just wanted to mention that. But I was reading very widely. Dickens, I fell in love with Dickens, fell in love with Austen. I read very deeply, and this began to form my decision about what I was going to do when I was going to get out of the service. I was going to go to school and be an English major.
I think this is so interesting. And perhaps you would speculate for me as to why you started reading some of the world's great literature, as opposed to, you know, there were literally millions of books you could have chosen.
I think Dickens was easy, because, you know, he just has that wonderful appeal. And maybe it's because of a movie that I saw based on something that he wrote. I'm not quite sure what it was. But Dickens, you know, when Dickens was writing, he was writing to capture an audience. You know, the stuff would be published in serial form.
Yes.
And so he caught me. I loved his narrative style, and I just got caught up in him. And then from him, it was easy to start moving beyond him to others and so forth. But I read contemporary stuff as well. I'm not quite sure when in my life I started to become hooked on mystery novels, but at some early stage I was also reading mystery novels. I was reading trash stuff. I was reading everything, and was in the Air Force when I started to look at the New York Times. Wasn't widely available at that time, but I could get copies of it. And which became a lifetime habit of mine. When I went to Africa, if I could possibly do it, I had the New York Times sent to me in Africa. That started fairly early when I was in the Air Force. Not a great, not a religious kind of a thing that it is today, where it's an everyday kind of a thing. But I was, what was happening was that I was moving beyond Gary, and even beyond the United States with a much broader interest in things and people, in what was going on. The Korean War was fizzling out by this time, and it was and I was then aware that it wasn't a very wise decision for us to go in. I became much more aware of this later on, of course, with Vietnam. But by that time, I was here, and here, of course, it was a religion.
Yes.
I met a lot of interesting people in the Air Force and kept contact with them for a long period of time afterwards. So it was, from the point of view of people I met, of things that I learned, of the broadening experience that it had, and the separation from Gary, Indiana, and I really separated. I didn't have to worry about offending anybody, so church was out from here on in. The parochialism of Gary, I was trying to break that. I still maintained contact with my family, of course, but they could feel me, sort of separating, I think.
Were you the only one to leave Gary?
Yeah. My older brother was in the Navy, so he left Gary, but he's back. They came back. And he retired some years ago from working in the steel mills. So, another brother was in the Army, and they live in Phoenix, Arizona now, and he's a tradesman. He works with wood and things like that. And then my youngest brother was in the reserves, and he's a politician in the Gary area today. None of the three went to university, but by and large, all their children have gone to university, I think. The Air Force, I hesitate to leave the Air Force alone because it was 4 years, and that's a big chunk of my life. There was also the routine of the Air Force that gets to you after a while. There are certain things that that you simply have to deal with, but that taught me patience to a certain extent anyway. And then when I got out, I remember I was not I wanted to study English Lit, which everybody thought was crazy. How are you going to make a living, with English Lit? And I was going to go either to Columbia or to Michigan, and ended up going to Michigan because there were some well-known professors in the English department there that I wanted to work with. So I went to Ann Arbor, and
so you knew you were going to be an academic.
Yeah,
you wanted an intellectual life.
Yeah, Pretty much, maybe early in the Air Force career, but most certainly by the end of the Air Force career, I knew that that was what I was going to do. And so it was really a matter of just, I just set the my sights in that direction, and I was moving in that direction. I wasn't quite sure exactly what was going to happen, but I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And so went to Michigan. And while I was at Michigan, I remember twice Eleanor Roosevelt coming to lecture at the university. They had a lot of lectures, just like Wisconsin does. And I would never have missed her for this. I still remember her, this tall woman, stooped, probably because of her height, you know, because she was above, you know, soared above everybody. And coming on the stage at Michigan and looking, you know, sort of, it was moving towards the end of her life by this time. But when, I still remember when this woman smiled, it was just magnificent. She just lit up everything. She had an absolutely wonderful smile. And it was wonderful to hear her talk. And she just underscored, I didn't learn anything new at her talks. It was just wonderful to see her and have her underscore everything that I had read about her and believed in her. You know, she sort of underscored that. So that was really for me, it sort of put paid to, you know, the earlier influence that she had on me. I think that by this time she was pretty much woven into me.
And we're talking the late 1950s.
So this is in the late 1950s. So I went to Michigan in 54 or 55 or something like that. I'm not quite sure when Eleanor Roosevelt died, but she was, you know, she was moving into old age when I saw her. And I saw many other speakers there. Got my jazz injections regularly, and also lots of classical music that I went regularly to hear concerts. And again, did a lot of reading. And you know, when I think back about my life in at the University of Michigan, I was trying to think about teachers who sort of stood out. And I don't think I really had any outstanding teachers, teachers who really sort of grabbed a hold of me and shaped me. Any shaping that I did, I think I was in control of by that time, by the time I was at Michigan. The GI Bill was, you know, was considerable, but it wasn't enough to get me through. I could never borrow, my parents were very poor. I remember once borrowing $200 from my father for a 1 month period, just to get me over a rough period in Michigan, but I never borrowed any money from him. The only other money I ever borrowed, I think, was $200 from a fellow student of mine there. So I was pretty much on my own, and got a job while I was at Michigan as these residence hall advisors. In a place called Strauss House in East Quad, I remember, and I was there for some years, and so that was helpful to me because it taught me a lot. I worked with students regularly, and also it helped me financially.
And you would have been older than the students.
That's right. I met Roger Wilkins there. He was. I think we were called TAs. No, not TAs. I forgot what we were called. But he was in that position just before I did. And so.
Oh, really?
And so yeah, when he was here in Madison a few years ago. We sort of, relived those early Strauss House contacts. But he's a graduate of Michigan.
And he was, for the record here, he became head of the NAACP.
No, that's Roy.
That was,
I think, his uncle.
Okay.
Roger Wilkins is he was on the editorial board of the New York Times for quite some time. He teaches in Washington at I don't know if it's Georgetown or exactly what. But he's in the news quite a bit, and he's also been on talk shows a lot, especially those that dealt with major racial issues in this country. Yeah, the and, And something else is happening in this country when I was at Michigan. And that is 1954, the Supreme Court decision ending segregation in the schools. Now we're moving into the time of Rosa Parks and of the continued segregation in the South. Mm-hmm. And so I'm aware, vaguely aware, of things that are starting to happen even as far north as Ann Arbor. And Ann Arbor was, like Madison, you know, a very liberal city. I think it was at Kresge's there that they sort of demonstrated a kind of a sit-in. But of course, this wasn't a real problem in Ann Arbor. It was in support of what was happening as African Americans were going into restaurants in the South that were supposedly closed to African Americans and sitting in. And so there's a little bit of that, not much, but you're really aware of a national cranking up of the desire of African Americans now, with the impetus of the 1954 Supreme Court decision behind them, pushing towards full equality in this country. So that's happening in the background. In the meantime, I'm reading everything imaginable. I did my master's thesis on the Great Gatsby, and
you did?
Yeah, and I studied contemporary American literature, as well as English lit. But you know, the thing that I was really interested in was really early stuff, Beowulf, the oral traditions of the English literature. And so that really fascinated me, and so that began to grow in my mind. American lit interested me, English lit interested me, but here was something else that started at an early period. A couple of courses I took interested me. I took a course in Chaucer, who was very close to the oral tradition, and took things out of the oral tradition. Took courses in Shakespeare, where I became aware of how Shakespeare took stuff out of the oral tradition and made his plays out of it. And so this begins to sort of percolate in my mind. So I get my I did my BA and MA back-to-back at Michigan, made very, very close friends among fellow students. One of my closest friends is a physicist. So it was a continued broadening of my scope. Spent a lot of time in the libraries. Ann Arbor was, I really enjoyed it. It was just a very comfortable time. But I always, it's as the university is, it's always on the cusp. But I wasn't a young kid anymore, and so I was kind of anxious, to get started doing something. Mm-hmm. So I got my BA with distinction from Michigan. I was more and more, in control of myself, more and more self-confident. I enjoyed my master's degree work. I was becoming more obstreperous in the classroom, with my own ideas and so forth, in seminars. So yeah, it was good. I really loved, it's just that at that time Ann Arbor was just a tiny little, university town. It's grown quite a bit since then. But it was good. And then the fact that Michigan attracted such an enormous number of speakers and music groups and so forth from around the world, that provided again this broader kind of scope that fascinated me.
And Michigan was a top flight school.
It was a very
then,
yeah,
was
oh yeah
it, was
yeah,
it not
yeah, it was a very good school. So when I got my master's, I my GI Bill had run out, and I did want to go on for my PhD, but for money purposes. And also simply because, I needed a break, like many people do. So the possibility of teaching at Valparaiso University in Indiana came along. My parents love this because it's a Lutheran university.
Lutheran school.
And And so I went there. It was just, you know, what you, when you go to school with a master's degree, you go to schools like that, you're fodder. You know, what you are is you teach these three composition courses, you know, that are mind-boggling, because all you're ever doing in your life is marking papers, you know, a paper a week. And they give you one lit course to sort of, as a palliative, you know, to sort of calm you down. So I have a lit course and three comp courses, and I really wasn't prepared, you know, intellectually, and you know, at Michigan for teaching comp courses. So I had to do a lot of work in that grammar and that sort of thing. But it was good for me. But the lit course was wonderful. It was an English lit course, and I really enjoyed that. Small school, 4,000. You know, out in this, again, Valparaiso, the city was just, you know, a tiny little community that was a service community for the farmers, you know, in that area.
So the kids were primarily Indiana?
Not necessarily, because it was a religious institution. They came from a number of different places in the country. It wasn't quite as cosmopolitan, you know, as it might have been, but you know, it was somewhat cosmopolitan. There were black students there. But again, the, you know, religion was pretty heavy at that place. So I taught for a year, but I was looking around. And then the thing that changed my life completely, and this was just on a, you know, I always had a vague interest in Africa, but never to the extent that it would become a part of my life. I become aware halfway through my year at Valpo, and I'm really enjoying myself at Valpo, by the way, earning $4,500 a year. And so they had to give you subsidized housing, you know, because, you know, it was really, at that time, a shoestring type thing. I'm trying to remember. One of the big events at Valparaiso was the assassination of Kennedy.
Oh, you were there?
And I was there. I'm trying to think of, I think it was before, no, it must have been after I came back.
But that was 1963.
So that was when I came back from Uganda. So this didn't happen yet. So I'm looking around, you know, Valparaiso, you know, wasn't interested in people like me for a career because we didn't have our PhDs or anything. You know, everybody knows that this is a way station. Uh-huh. But it was good. I loved it. I loved the students. It was really great. But then the possibility, lots of things were happening in Africa. African countries were moving towards freedom in, you know, many of them at this period. It was really picking up a lot of steam. In East Africa, Uganda, then it was called Tanganyika, and then Kenya, they were moving towards independence. So they needed the British, who were the at that time the colonial power there. Germany had been earlier in Tanganyika, but Britain was in control now. They hadn't prepared the people for independence. Mm-hmm. So, and this is before the Peace Corps. Oh no, this has to be. Yeah, so Kennedy is still very much alive because he's a part of this. The Peace Corps wasn't in existence yet. Actually, Kennedy announced the Peace Corps at Michigan, some years later.
Yes, he did.
So they needed 150 American teachers and 150 British teachers to go to the high schools to teach, because there wasn't they didn't have enough high school graduates to start putting nations together. And I leapt at this. I didn't have an education certificate, but they weren't requiring that. I really wasn't that interested in teaching in high school, but the very idea of going interested me. So there was quite a bit of competition to get into it, but I got in. And it was going to be for 2 years, 1961 to 3, I think, a year before independence and a year after independence. So I went to, it was Columbia University was sponsoring this, went to New York, fell utterly and totally in love with New York. God, I love that place. And I,
you know, was your first trip.
First trip to aside from Chicago, to a really big city. I love that place. And I had a lot of trouble staying in Columbia while I was there. I really wanted to explore this place. Saw plays. I saw Richard Burton in in some place called Julie Andrews. I just saw, you know, I just soaked everything up. It was just wonderful. And a lot of music, jazz. But they were teaching us, they were preparing us. We had a bit of Swahili there, but it wasn't enough for us to get around with. But we studied a bit of Swahili, at least the structure of the language. And then, you know, how to behave. This was, for America, this was a new kind of a thing, of sending a large number of people to abroad to teach. I still remember the night before we were to leave, we went to the airport, and Julius Nyerere, who later became the head of Tanzania,
yes.
Young, idealistic, very dashing person, came to speak to us.
Uh-huh.
And how important, they weren't free yet in Tanzania either, it was still Tanzania, talking to us, it was just very exciting. All of us, I still remember, were very excited by this speech. And then we get on these airplanes. I mean, this is early 1960s, so we had some kind of a lumbering airplane. I can't remember what it was. We came in waves. There were three waves. I was in the first wave, they called it, the first group of the 150 who went. There were two other waves that came after us. The plane landed in Kano, Nigeria, on the way, and it blew out a tire. And this is my first trip, my first real trip to Africa. So, and they didn't have a tire. They had to send to Portugal to get a tire.
Oh my God!
So that meant we had to stay in Kano for almost a week. It was wonderful. Kano, northern Nigeria, a very Islamic area. I don't know if they were supposed to do this, but they allowed us to go up into the minaret of one of the mosques. Saw the dye pits where the people dyed clothing. These pits,
yes.
and on the ground and so forth. Went to the markets. It was wonderful. It was my first real experience of Africa, and I really loved it. And then we went on to Kampala. Well, we went to Makerere University at Kampala. That's where the initiation process continued. And then they told us where we were going to go, which of the three countries. And
oh, you didn't know yet?
No. And my assignment was Masindi Senior Secondary School in Uganda, which is in... And near the Ruwenzori Mountains, the Mountains of the Moon, near the in the kingdom of Bunyoro. And so we had a little bit more, preparation, and then off we went. And in my school, there were three teachers. There was a British headmaster, and there was another British teacher, and then I was the third. It was a boarding school for boys. I learned pretty fast that in order for kids to come to the school, they better be Christians. So you had Muslims who became Christians overnight, and you had people who are not Christians who became Christians overnight, because this is the way this made sense to me, because this was their ticket, you know, out. And so they were, you know, it was a boarding school. Masindi was just a tiny little town at that time. At night in Masindi, there was a lot of activity, I remember, in that city. I didn't understand what the heck was going on in this sort of sleepy little town. But I learned pretty quickly that it was an illegal trade in rhino horn. And the rhino horn was smuggled out of Uganda into Kenya, down to Mombasa, and then it would go on boats over to India, where it was sold for great amounts of money because it was an aphrodisiac. And it also was killing the rhino population. But this was going on regularly at night. Maybe ivory tusks from elephants as well. I mean, we were in the, you know, sort of the quintessential, stereotypical Africa. In my backyard, I remember the headmaster's dog killed a civet cat one night
in
my yard. It wasn't very far, where you could see the elephants and the hundreds of zebra and that sort of thing. So it was pretty remote, and two of the happiest years I have ever spent. It was just wonderful. I was busy much of the time in school because I was teaching things I never dreamed I would teach. I was a history. I taught history. I was a soccer coach. I'd never seen a soccer game in my life, but the kids were so good at that they taught me pretty fast what the game was all about.
And these are boys 12,
this
13.
Was high school, that's right.
Or maybe a little older.
Yeah, a little older than that. And they would be, I remember, William Makepeace Olmedine. They would take, British names. So I was really busy. That first year, I didn't have much time to catch my breath.
Harold, were they speaking English or were you speaking?
And the thing is, nobody spoke Swahili here. So even if I had really mastered Swahili, it wouldn't have done me much good. There was a kind of a kitchen, they called it kitchen Swahili, which people would have understood. But it was Lunyoro Utoro was the language here, and that's what the people spoke. The kids, because they came from all over Uganda, and even further from other parts of East Africa, English became the lingua franca. But English was also the language in the classroom.
Uh-huh.
Because I certainly wasn't ready. I had no real language training yet for Africa. It was great. And they had this British system of preparing kids to take the exams. And so everything was preparing them to take the exams. And I tried to, to loosen that up a bit so that there would be, an excitement about learning ideas and so forth and not just preparing for an exam. The headmaster didn't like this. The headmaster turned me in twice because I wasn't behaving properly. And they came up to investigate me because I wasn't working, within the harness of the British system. I couldn't live with this idea of writing stuff on the board, kids memorize it, and then spit it up, That didn't interest me at all. In the meantime, back here in this country, at Valparaiso and elsewhere, we had no library. People were gathering books. And so they were regularly sending books to us, and so I was also in the process of building a library. I remember we had extracurricular activities. We had a drama class. So I directed Macbeth one year, and at the last minute, the guy who was playing Macbeth had to drop out because of academic reasons, and I played Macbeth. It was something I didn't mind at all because I'm a real ham, and so it was kind of fun. We had no electricity in the evenings, and so we had lanterns and so forth to light up the stage. It was really kind of fun. I'm trying to think now. I don't think I had electricity the whole time I was there. I had a house. I remember in my house, I had a house to myself there. And on one of the walls, it's probably still there, people are still cussing me. I put a huge Picasso painting that I took. I took from one of his paintings on the wall, and that's the only time in my life I ever had a dog. I remember.